This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth Tree Dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the Tree Runner, or the classic low-top look of the Tree Piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. My name's Travis Dow. And this episode has been on the list for a while. It's also a popular request, namely Slavic peoples living within the German Empire. And, you know, they still do. We've talked about Germans and Celts, Germans and Romans, and to their east starts the endless sea of Slavic languages and peoples. In the chronological episodes, like in the mini-series of the Franks and Saxons, we've mentioned these Slavs, these people that keep getting conquered and forced baptized. So this episode is about them, like I promised. From Charlemagne to Otto the Great to the Salians, have Slavs being converted by German missionaries to conquest and even colonization. And this episode is about the Slavic peoples mostly living within Germany going back a millennium or so to about the timeline where I am in the chronological episodes. And this episode is also about the Slavic history within the Holy Roman Empire and Germany, especially, or one of the Slavic groups are the Wends or Wends or the Wenden in German. It's not a very accurate term for anyone, really. Better would be Sorbs, maybe that's also familiar, around Lusatia, Lausitz, which is today that kind of straddles the German-Polish border. It's close to the Czech Republic. Now, the problem with Wends is there are one problem, there's many problems, but there's also Wendish speakers in Slovenia. But actually, the etymology is much messier than that, so there's a lot of problems here when referring to people called Wends. Going way back to Roman times, we have peoples being called Venetia, Venice, Venete in the Roman Empire, which was Celtic Veneters lived in the time of Caesar in Gaul. And then there's Venetians in the East Alps, kind of north of the Adriatic Sea. And then there's a third Venetia, which is just kind of known from hearsay during the time of Pliny or Tacitus or Ptolemy. And then in the early Middle Ages, so these were kind of further away and they were up near the Baltic. And then when specifically talking about Slavic people, they kind of, it was more referred to as the Solones or Stavani that reached all the way into, you know, into the area of the Alanin. So yeah, so in the Roman times, we don't really get our Slavic Wends. Okay, so who are the Wends? We still don't have an answer. The Germans now started to use this term, Wends, for random peoples who spoke Romance languages. So what do those people on the other side of the Rhine speak? Don't know, can't understand them. Some Welsh, okay? And the guys south of the Alps? Heck if I know, they're just Welching. And that's kind of at least how I imagine it. And more to my point, more concretely, those guys in Romania, the area known as Wallachia, it's still known as Wallachia, like where Vlad the Impaler ruled, as in the guy that's in inspired Dracula. Yeah, that so it just means like Wallonian or Valachai, like Wallachia in Romania. It just kind of means foreign, like the foreign things, the people that speak a different language. A Valach, yeah, so like there's Romanian peoples were mentioned, you know, in the late 18th century from the German Valach, Valache, which, yeah, also has ties to the old Church Slavonic Vlachu, or from the old High, yeah, so like Val, but really like Vlach, really to someone that speaks a foreign language. It's kind of like someone that speaks gibberish is, he's speaking Welsh. And it could be, like, related is a really old Germanic word, Valha, which could describe Celts. Same thing, I mean, and then this was later Romanized. And kind of referred to all the Romance speaking peoples. I mean, it just kind of spread from there, but it's a very old term is what I'm trying to get across. In fact, that exists in English more directly, like in, as in Wales or Cornwall or Wallonia. Yeah. But, in Southeast Europe, there's all kinds of, things that refer to Romanians like Vlach and Blach and, Bloch and, or Boloch. And it's all just kind of like, it's, yeah, they're all just, we don't know. There's a part of Switzerland that no one can understand called the Welsh, Schweiz. It's the Welsh speaking Swiss. And then, you know, the Anglo-Saxons, who were also speaking Germanic languages, they came across the original Britons and they didn't understand what they were saying. So that's where we get the term Wales. In fact, the Welsh themselves didn't call themselves that. They're like Cambrians. This is a Germanic term for the people that speak gibberish. And you see that not just when referring to Wales on the British Isles, but in areas in Gaul, and then, like I already mentioned, Romania, but just all kinds of place names like Valland and Vala, and you know, something related to it all comes back to like Welsh, that kind of thing. Same with Cornwall in or southwestern England, and even such things like Walloon or even the Walnut is just a, you know, a nut from a foreign place. And surnames Walsh and Wallace, for instance. That's all that means. It was just place names that mean gibberish. And in German to this day, there's an old term dating back from the 16th century at least that just says, the term is Kauderwelsch, which is just a mix of foreign languages or even just gibberish. Like, I don't know what he's speaking. It's Kauderwelsch. Now, don't worry, the Czechs, which is Slavic, their name for Germans is Niemetzki, meaning the same thing. It is those who cannot speak. So it's mutual. Okay, but now the Welsh, Cornwall, all that, those were referring to Britons, to like British Isle Celts. So we're still not quite, still not on the right track there, because we're looking for Slavs that are called Wends or Wends, Wenden. Now to narrow it down a little further, in the upper German area, speak like Bavarian and Austrian area, the term Windisch was used to note people that were speaking Slavic, like their Slavic-speaking neighbors, both north and south of the Alps. So Bavarians and Austrians started to look east and, you know, north and south of themselves. And those Slavic-speaking people amongst themselves, they said they speak Windisch, okay? And now, like this Windisch, with an E, Wendisch, or like Wenden, are now just the Elp Slavs, and Windisch with an I is this one language in Slovenia. It's a Slovenic language, or rather the Slovenic language. In Slovenia, according to Austrians and Germans, they speak Windisch. So the Bayou Wahren, the old Celtic or the old Bavarians, called this southern Slavic tribe the Windisch, okay? And this is kind of at the same time when there's a Latinizing of Veneti and Vineti and Veneti, these different Latin terms for a very similar kind of, some tribe that lived around there. Like Venice, for instance, also comes from that Latin version. So different, but potentially, you know, talking about peoples in the East. I don't want to throw in more confusion there because it's different. But narrowing it down even further to our Wends in Germany, so near where the Czech Republic, Poland, and Germany meet, there's an area called Lausitz, and this is more the, so now, so far I've just defined who we're not talking about, and our German Slavs. So in Nether Lausitz, we had, like, it's kind of near, it's in Brandenburg, in the state of Brandenburg. So eastern Germany. And yeah, so we have Wenden and Sorben, like the Sorbs. These are our Slavs living in Germany. And especially in eastern German, like in GDR times, Sorbs would just be everybody, like Nether and like lower and upper Lausitz. But really, so the Sorbs are in upper Lausitz. Maybe the Wends are in Nether, lower Lausitz. So there's a difference there in the two types of Slavs, which, you know, probably goes back a millennium. I mean, this is the time, the reason I bring this episode up now is These are the peoples that the Ottonians and Salians were conquering and converting to Christianity and that kind of thing. So these Sorbs and people that they called Vens. Okay, now Sorbs also, there's... it's worth mentioning something here because you might notice that that sounds very similar to Serb with an E, and I don't want to throw in confusion here. So Serbs are is a Balkan people. So Serbia is in the Balkan states, like Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia means South Slavic. So southern, you know, southeastern Europe by Greece there. Macedonia is one of those states. So way down there is where the Serbs are. Sorbs is much further north in Europe. But again, Serbs and Sorbs are both Slavic peoples. So there's clearly something to this. So what does Serb mean? Just to clarify, so this Yugoslav peoples. In 1813, we have a reference to the Vens, okay? Like 1861, as native of Serbia. Whoa, what? So the Vens are native of Serbia. That's weird. And this is, so there's a Serbian term called Serb, S-R-B, who's also one of my former landlord's last names. But anyways, you shouldn't know that. That just might mean man, like old Slavic, it just means man. So just the people, you know, that goes back to just the folk, the peoples. So Serbian is attested to 1848 as a noun and 1876 as an adjective. So those Serbians, okay, as a people. And yeah, but in more common in the 19th century was Serbian with a V. And now Sorb, we have, it goes at least back to 1843 from the German Sorbe. And then there's also, you know, from the Slavic Serb. But in this case, really referring to people from Lusatia, Eastern Saxony and Brandenburg, that area. Okay, so now we know we are talking about Slavs living within what is today the eastern part of Germany that have been there for 1,000+ years. Okay, just to recap, because yeah, we're already 15 minutes into it and we're just now defining who we're actually talking about. We went from Romans, descriptions of people called Venetiae, whatever, to Germans calling Romanized Celts Welsh and Valach, to finally setting on just the close Slavs being called that. So we get the Slavic Vens in the Holy Roman Empire to differentiate between Celtic, Welsh, and Cornwall, and the Romance-speaking Wallachia in today's Romania. Okay, so let's now find out more about the Slavic ones living in the empire, the Vens and Sorbs. Who were they now? And this is to shed light on peoples we mentioned in passing in the Frankish and Saxon miniseries. Okay, so finally, here we go. How did these peoples live? What did that look like before the Charlemagnes and Heinrichs and Otto started conquering, okay? Through archaeology, we see kind of parapets, like mounds for walls, and as well as open settlements. And this oldest archaeological culture is what's known as the Prager culture from the 7th century. So just a very old Slavic, which is just, it's called that because it was first discovered around Prague. But yeah, it goes beyond that area. But that goes way back. So there were Slavs living in that area way back when, and then they were, later there was the Feldberg, culture, the Feldberger ceramic culture, Menkendorfer ceramic, the Leipzig group. So there's other Slavic groups, kind of, you know, wave after wave of immigration, or they just kind of changed their cultures over times. Very similar to the way we saw with Celts. Like if you recall, I did a mini series on the Celts and talked about Hallstatt being one archaeological level where there's, you know, there's several different levels over a vast long time period. The culture has kind of changed. So what we had there with Celts, here we have with Slavs. So the oldest one was Prager, and then, you know, a younger one was Leipziger group. But yeah, what we see is, you know, they're not hunter gatherers, or they're not nomadic. They're also farmers, settled agricultural peoples, just like their German neighbors, growing wheat and rye and raising cattle and pigs and sheep and chickens. The basic necessities that the Germans next to them had to. The oldest ceramic was, you know, hand formed, but you know, without a potting wheel and that kind of thing, pretty plain. We do see iron working, and we also see, you know, working of wood and stone and bone and leathers and you know, everything else you'd expect. And generally pretty open, so not, you know, not a lot of like heavily fortified city walls and everything. Usually near rivers or even right on lakes, kind of thing, in the range of 8 to 20 houses, like, which I guess you can assume are households. The houses are often pretty small, basically square rather than, you know, long rectangular houses, and often kind of lowered into the dirt. This is, yeah, you see other cultures do this too, and it's just, it kind of helps with insulation and that kind of thing. Yeah, or, you know, you're kind of, yeah, it's just a lowered house, so you're kind of in the cellar. Now later, and this is kind of interesting because, especially my German version, people might know this if you live in certain parts of Germany. So I will kind of have to clarify this in the German version more, I expect. But these Rundlingdorf, these round, it's actually kind of a horseshoe shaped, like a semicircle in a way, but, you know, horseshoe shaped villages where in the middle you just have this you know, open area, just a lawn or whatever, just an open area where you could have your festivals or whatever, and then open to one side, so I guess it's easy to ride in and out. I have no idea. And then all the houses are in this semicircle, or, you know, kind of even a horseshoe, just open on one end, laid out, and then it's all farmhouses, and then behind you on is where your slice of farmland would be, and then each village would be walking distance away from the next village, even just, you know, couple like 10 kilometers or whatever, so just one a half day to a day or so away, so pretty tightly packed actually, and, you know, just very efficient way of doing agriculture. Now, the thing is that these villages were not found to be super ancient, of like the ones I was, you know, like not the Prager culture or the Leipzig group. If you look up Rundling, this is, yeah, so you see it's like it's described as farms like spokes in a wheel with around a common green. And you can still see these in Germany, and some places evolved out of these, especially if the place name, you know, it has a Slavic ending like Itz or Alf, like those are Slavic place names endings. In today's Wendland, especially in Germany, that was I would say that's more from the medieval period, not from the ancient prehistoric Slavic days. And was much more of a way to colonize and just, you know, effectively settle this area within already German Holy Roman Empire times. So whether it was Germans living like this or just because of the place names you would think would be Slavs, it was within the Holy Roman Empire. So you don't see these Rundling villages. Rundlingdorf just means Rundling village. You don't see them further east. Like, you don't really see them in the Czech Republic, even, as far as I know. I don't know. That's really strange. You don't see them in Poland. You don't see them, which Poland even had, you know, Germanic influences here and there. You don't see them further east. So, yeah, it's strange. But, yeah, you do see this. And I would say it's there was this colonization from within the empire to colonize, you know, eastern parts of the empire. And that happened in the Middle Ages, really. And that's where these come from. But anyways, if you're around Wendland, there's still some villages that still have this. These were described in the Middle Ages by Bavarian and others. Yeah, so anyways, this is kind of a neat little village layout that's typical of that area. And now to give some background of the history of those peoples. In the 11th and 12th century, we have the Elp Slavs that were, so originally they were all non-Christian, and so they had their own Slavic pagan beliefs. And especially we have these important sites, like just known from, like not even known archaeologically sometimes, just known from historic records, of these sort of temple castles or temple burgs, like Kap Arkona in Rügen or Retra, I'll bring it up again in a minute, that's like super important, where they worshipped their gods like Radagast or Triglav, who I'm gonna circle back to. And we see in the 10th century, the first bishoprics being founded. Okay, so this is the, now we're going to start seeing some conflict between the German missionaries going east and the pagans like resisting, and then the Germans coming with swords and that kind of thing. But to give you guys a glimpse of what the Germans ran into, because I did not do that when I discussed this from the Saxon point of view, really, are, you know, who these pagan Slavs were. And the most important of their gods was Svarotsich or Radegost, the knowledge-seeking god, the one who could foretell the future. The Slavs themselves had a practice of trying to divine through oracles, and even had sacrifices for this purpose. They would throw lots to divine, and often this was, so these would be like, kind of like Celtic druids, I imagine. But these high priests, these people that really made the future by foretelling it, because if they predicted a bad omen or predicted a bad outcome, then the leaders, the tribal leaders would listen. So these priests had real power. Real political power. So when they threw lots, like, that really meant something. They also throw lots and then cover it with green grass and then kind of stick it with two lance spear tips. And then you take a holy horse and lead it over this whole mess. The attitude, the behavior of the horse would would be the divining. Like, you would read that, and that's, you know, that would be a bad omen or a good omen. And horses, it's interesting that they did it with horses, because the Celts were really into horses too. So, but yeah, anyways, so the Slavs used horses for divination as well. But sacrificial rituals were also recorded, trying to like calm the gods down, basically, who demanded blood of humans and people, apparently, especially the heads of enemies. So human victims would often be the enemies in war. And this is as late as like the early kind of 11th century. We still get, you know, reports from Germans being written of these kind of acts. John of Mecklenburg, who was a bishop, had his head put on a spike by these pagans as a sign of rebellion. So there's definitely religious conflict between the Christian Saxons and Franks and, you know, Germans, the Christian Germans, and now the Slavic pagans. And I described just a couple episodes ago the pagan Saxons being hounded by the Catholic Franks, and before that it was, you know, even a pagan Franks. So this is just kind of, you know, history does repeat itself, at least in this regard, that, you know, as you're moving east, you're conquering these pagan peoples and Christianizing them. So yeah, there's some parallels here, a little bit of deja vu. And the German contact with them went at least back to around the year 600. So the 7th century, along the Elbe and the Saale, you start to have Germanic peoples and Slavic peoples, you know, realizing that, hey, those other guys across the Elbe or across the Saale, I can't understand them. They speak funny. Either they're Nemetsky, like those who can't speak, or they're Welching around, like speaking gibberish. So starting near the Czech border in Bavaria today, we're going north into Saxony today, like into Germany today, there was Slavs there. Basically, yeah, end of the 7th century, you know, 8th century, that they were just kind of following the Baltic and heading further west, all the way of, you know, if you think of former East Germany, they filled that gap where centuries before the Great Migration, they vacated it from the Huns and all that, and, you know, Slavs came on in. So yeah, if you think of former Eastern Germany, they had a Slavic influence, at least, even if there were some Germanic speakers there. Yeah, there was also some Slavs moving into the area. We have the Abodrites specifically in the Western Baltic, and that's, I mentioned that because they're still, the Abodrites, you know, they're still in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. They're still there. I think there's still Slavic, like ethnically Slavic people in that part of Germany. So they were, the Obodrites, the Polabs, part of that group. There's many subgroups. I have a whole huge list of them. And I kind of feel like some of them are still alive today. So I feel like it's like they'll get insulted if I don't mention them, maybe, at least in German. But yeah, there's, I mean, the bits besides the huge groups like Abodrites and Sorbs, there's all kinds of smaller subgroups too, like a couple dozen. But okay, anyways, so in the 10th century, so now we have in the Saxon mini series, if you recall, and I promise I'd get back to this then, we have Heinrich the First, Otto the First conquering big swaths. 983, Otto the Second was busy in Italy, and he died like a loser besieging Venice, leaving his four-year-old son, when, bam, we have the Great Slavic Uprising. That's, yeah, that's what I mentioned that, and I mentioned that, okay, I'll come back to that. So here it is. Because anyways, this story is much more interesting from the Slavic point of view. Remember Radagast from The Lord of the Rings? The weird hermit wizard who lives in the woods and had bird poop in his hair? Well, Radagast is actually the name of a Slavic pagan god. Not in fantasy, but in real life. Tolkien got it from this. It's also the name of a Slavic holy place, more commonly known as Retra, I guess, because they don't have a th, Retra, these days. But more importantly, it's also the name of a Czech beer. Unfortunately, that's a different story. What's interesting is, or unfortunately, I should say, this holy place, this pagan Slavic holy place, is lost today. It's lost because even contemporary chroniclers had a bit of trouble getting the name right, and the god that was worshipped there. It was the religious and political center of the Lutetzen, in any case, and so from here they now plotted to get rid of their German/Christian overlords and go back to their pagan ways. Lutetzen was an alliance of some four Slavic tribes, all centered around that holy site, Retra. The priests of Retra were kind of in charge. So quote two sources here, Tietmar von Merseburg says, my translation is, in the Redarierg, there's a triangular and three-doored fortress, Radagast, like Radagast, surrounded by a huge, for the inhabitants, unharmable, holy forest. Two of its doors are open to all. The third, and the smallest, the east door, or east gate, goes to a path to a nearby, very dark sea. In the fortress, there's only a wooden relic that stands on a foundation made of the horns of different animals. And it's carved in like all kinds of pictures of gods and goddesses. And inside, it has like idols with their names carved in it. And Adam von Bremen says, between the Elbe and Oder, there are more Slavic tribes. In the middle is the strongest of them, the Redariers. And they live, or they're in, from Retra, the center of their sacrilegious beliefs. There stands a big temple to their idols, the highest of which is Radagast. His picture is made in gold, and his camp of purple. The fortress has 9 gates and is surrounded by a deep lake. So this differs from the previous one that says it has 3 gates and the lake's off to one side. But anyways, and then he also speaks of divination and the oracles and yeah, that kind of thing. The middle point of the fortress is this wooden temple. That's kind of what we're getting from Retra. And it's carved on the outside, you know, has idols on the inside. Is consecrated to Radagast. But anyways, you can see there's differences in their descriptions, and that's why it's hard to find out, you know, where the actual site is today, where the city was, and, you know, do some archaeological digs there, because it's lost. But, yeah, there's other reports from that time there, speaking of the Holy Horse and other, you know, religious rituals that they did at the time. Anyways, Retra wasn't just this place of worship in a religious sense, but also militaristically important. Like it was the capital in the terms of like when one tribe got in trouble, then here's where they all met, and then, you know, they'd all meet at Retra and then go attack out from there. Which brings me to the Great Slavic Uprising in 983, which is now a couple episodes ago. We have the Polabian Slavs, the Vens, the Lutitsi and Obotrites. These are different various tribes, and they lived east of the Elbe. And they all decide to revolt. This is, you know, because Otto II had just died, and, you know, Otto III is like 4 years old, and so, you know, why not? It's a good time. They put a bishop's head on a spike and marched off to a city. They started from Retra, and the bishop's seat of Havelberg is where they ended up on the 29th of June, 983. They occupied and plundered it, and then they marched off to Brandenburg, kind of hitting up the settlements along the Tanger River. More Slavs joined along the way, according to Tietmar of Merseburg, and they even did a failed assault on Hamburg. And finally now the Saxons, you know, just kind of assembled an army and went off to stop all this. But we're not able. In the end, some of the Slavs threw off their, you know, kind of went back to their pagan ways and set that part back, you know, for about a century or so, or at least set Christianity back for about a century, and, weren't conquered and occupied again for another 100 years. In 1003, Henry II tried a different approach. He allied himself with the Lutitsi and waged war, so kind of divide and conquer, because he needed him against his war of Boleslav. And Boleslav, remember, I think Henry II was the one that had like 14 years of war against. Yeah, it was, because the Ottos were always allied with Boleslav, but Henry didn't have that alliance. So he had like 14 years. So he used the Lutitsi, these Slavs living even closer, and fought the Poles with them as allies. This, however, legitimized the Lutitsi, meaning they were more autonomous and independent because they were helping Henry. So they were, you know, they had more autonomy, basically, is what that meant. And so they stayed unchristianized until the 12th century. Only in future episodes basically for 200 years, we do not have an actual bishop in Havelberg, for instance. That's like one symptom of how this was re-paganized, and it stopped Christianity in its tracks for a couple hundred years. In that time, Poland, Bohemia, even Hungary were all becoming Christianized and had Christian rulers. But here, these Vens, Sorbs, the Lutitsi, did not. They remained pagan, and the bishopric of Havelberg didn't exist for 200 years. Basically, it just, you know, the bishopric did in name only, but there was no bishop. Like, it was, yeah, I mean, they were all pagans. So that's kind of interesting. And then only in the 12th century did it, which we're not there yet chronologically, did they start to reconquer, like Henry the Lion and these. They started to ally themselves back with the empire and re-Christianize and everything, and re-Germanize then later, which, hold on, I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, so now that's where we are kind of chronologically. So so now I've kind of caught up. Now, just to summarize this, because I don't want to keep having to separate Slavs from Germans. That's kind of silly. Now, Retra, I want to just mention that it has been sought after. Like, this, the fact that it's lost is not, like, because no one's looked for it. Since the 14th century, there has been theories on where it is. Since the 16th century, like 1519, there's a theory that since it's by Burg Stargard. There's little statues here and there saying that this is the place, that's the place. Because there's like one idol got dug up in the 18th century, so 1768, where the word Retra was carved into it. But yeah, I mean, it was probably a forgery. There's just all kinds of, I mean, I don't say it lightly that it's lost, this pagan holy site, because it's not lost, you know, over negligence. Like, people really looked for it. And there's all kinds of German local folklore about it and all of this. So it's really interesting. There's I could go off and talk for another hour just on Retra and the different attempts at finding it. And because it's hundreds of years now, that history. So that's really interesting. But instead, let's find out what happened to the people that we do know where they were, namely the Wends. And in the starting in the 11th century, which is where we are chronologically in the other episodes, but especially the 12th and 13th century, we will start to talk about the Wendish Crusade, and then the Crusades further east, and the Teutonic Knights, and all of that. But yes, so the Wendish Crusade is called a crusade because it was Christians against pagans, and you know, to try and convert them. And this brings us to a very long tradition of oppression and slow but sure Germanization. And that has to be said because if you look for Sorbs and Wends, they're few and far between. And they all speak German or Polish or Czech, I guess, here and there. But their languages have definitely been dying out. And it is. So there are West Slavic languages and dialects in the Holy Roman Empire that were just, because it's like basically a millennium of Germanization now that they just kind of didn't survive or are extremely endangered if they did survive. In the 15th century, there was laws or rules against using Wendish languages. Even in 1517, 1519, somewhere in there is Martin Luther's time, and even Martin Luther is recorded of saying, kind of, because he lived in the eastern part of Germany. Wittenberg is like in eastern Germany, and he is recorded cursing these Wendish speakers, quote unquote, the farmers in the area around Wittenberg. So, I mean, we definitely have Wendish speakers, you know, the 600 years later in the 16th century. They're still described here and then up until the 18th century. Like, there's still that the language exists. And often these historians would confuse Wends with Vandals, to be honest. So, like, they would often confuse these Slavic speakers with an East Germanic, you know, Vandal, like East kind of Ostrogoth speakers, which was just historically inaccurate. You know, the great migration, the people's migration. The Vandals went all the way to northern Africa and were gone, and this and that. So these are Slavic peoples, not Germanic at all. But we do have that just many many sources throughout the ages. Throughout the centuries, mention the Wends, and in fact, they survived until the 20th century for sure. And then there's kind of weirdnesses that happened. So after World War II, 1945, a big chunk of East Prussia was cut in half because they were very warlike and kept starting world wars and stuff. So Prussia was cut in half, and the eastern part was given to Poland. And Poland was like, great. Well, now we also have, so Germans were kicked out and sent west, but the Wends and Sorbs were kind of an exception because they're saying, well, they're Slavic, so they should stay and de-Germanize and now speak a Slavic language again. But the funny thing is that they'd been living they're German for a millennium. That's just kind of ludicrous and crazy. That's really romanticizing history. And in fact, these people wanted to leave because they wanted to go to West Germany and they wanted to go to the Bundesrepublik Deutschland and wanted to also bypass East Germany and for political reasons and economic reasons and had way more to do with historic reasons or what language they spoke. Way more realistic reasons, really. That's kind of interesting. So there was this thing in communism. There was an attempt to Slavicize these Sorbs and Wends, and those people fought back and went to West Germany. Yeah. So it's not black and white. We're talking about going from a communist country. I mean, yeah, that's the thing. There's this weirdness in communist times. They basically failed. They thought of themselves as German. So when I said earlier that there was 1,000 years of oppression and Germanization, well, okay, but now they're German. Maybe they still spoke their house language. Like maybe at home to their children and husband and wife, they would speak a Slavic, Wendish, Sorbish language, or just some words or a mix or whatever. But as soon as they stepped out the front door, they were German. Kind of like the Crimean Goths, but the other way around. the exact opposite, other way around. So there's still several thousand, tens of thousand of people that still claim to speak these. So there are like 20 to 30,000 Sorbic speakers. In 1900, there was 150,000. So, but yeah, I mean, it still exists is the short answer. There's maybe up to 50,000 Slavic, you know, German Slavic speakers that speak this thousand-year-old Slavic language and just kind of hung on there because, yeah, I mean, they were all Slavic before. So, you know, being 1,000 years of Germany, finally there, you know, it's 50,000 of them left up to. And if you are traveling around Germany, you might see place names like Vendeburg or Wende, Wenden, there's 1,000 Wende, Wendewisch, Wendessen, Wendehausen, whatever. Those all basically come from that. So if you're driving through Wendisch Bromne or Wendisch Fähre or Wendisch Hagen, all any of those combinations, and you're like, hey, those are from the Wends. That's 1,000-year-old. You're probably in Eastern Germany, probably. But in Saxony and Brandenburg, that area, even in Poland, all kinds of places that have Wendish or Sorbian in the name, and they're still around. So there are still speakers that do this. So yes, they're still there, and hence some of you might be, you know, genetically Slavic German. You might come from these Sorbs or Wends or Lausitz folk, and that's why so many of you have been asking for this, I guess, which is kind of interesting that, yeah, I mean, it definitely still exists. So Otto the Great and his campaigns and Henry way back when, there's the people he conquered are still kind of, they still self-identify as Slavic, I guess, or at least Wendish or Sorbish or something, which is interesting. I wasn't super aware of that. So yeah, that's neat. When I do the German episode, I wonder how that'll turn out. So I wonder how much feedback I'll get. I'm interested to know. Let me mention really quick that the History of Germany podcast is an Agora podcast member. This month is the awesome Ben Jacobs, Wittenberg to Westphalia, is the podcast of the month for Agora. And definitely give him a listen. I did a guest episode for him once, and he's... he hasn't been on the show. He'll be on the show soon, I do believe. I don't even know if it's this show, but yeah, Ben and I, we got something in the works again. I do have a new podcast out. It's called Africa, A History. If you go to podcastnik.com, there's links. It's on iTunes, all that. So there's a new podcast out. I am also part of the Dark Myths Collective. I'd like to mention The Lone Gunman. Lone Gunman's a great podcast that I've... So now I'm slowly getting to listen to, kind of working my way through some of the dark myths, because they're not all history podcasts. So normally I'd just listen to history podcasts, but because I'm a Dark Myths member, I try to listen to some of the other ones, and yeah, like, I'm pleasantly surprised. The Lone Gunman is one of the shows that I'm enjoying lately, so I'd like to give that one a shout out. And what else? The new Bohemican episodes are out, new Secret Cabinet episodes are out. Africa content is coming out soon. The Secret Cabinet, there's a couple new ones out and more to come. So go find all of that on podcastnik.com. That's podcastnik.com. And remember, the best way to help out a podcast, period, is review us on iTunes. If you go review History of Germany podcast on iTunes and give me a 5-star rating, that helps a lot. That gets me attention to folk that have never heard of the show before. So even if you're an Android user, that still helps to go rate us on iTunes, because a lot of the stuff comes from iTunes, and yeah, that's where it all kind of lives. Much appreciated. And otherwise, vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way.
Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.